I next met with Dr. Richard Penson, and he began our conversation by presenting a patient who came to him for a fifth opinion.
A 53-year-old sort of realtor, a real estate developer, fairly affluent. We were seen as the fifth opinion after optimally cytoreduced stage 3B, poorly differentiated grade 3 serous carcinoma of the ovary. She has a family history of a mother with breast cancer at 55 and an aunt with liver cancer. She's had gene testings, BRCA1 and 2 mutation negative, despite that family history, and has a fairly long history of ulcerative colitis. And that actually was the issue that made intraperitoneal chemotherapy a slightly difficult option in terms of her choices. And she sought out a lot of opinions.
Could I just ask, what was her current treatment for the ulcerative colitis?
Very little. She had what I would call sort of burnt out ulcerative colitis and was sort of playing this dangerous risk of having had possibly pancolitis, not wanting a colectomy. And the normal teaching is that at 10 years, your risk of a colorectal cancer really starts to escalate. And there are flat plaque-like lesions that are hard to find on screening. And so she was gambling, I think, on the basis that she thought it was not a pancolitis. But that was in question.
So what were the major treatment options for her? And what had she heard from other people?
So she was well-resourced, proactive sort of consumer, and was really motivated to get the very best chance of being cured. So she'd read about intraperitoneal chemotherapy, and two of the five key opinion leaders sort of endorsed intraperitoneal chemotherapy, despite the concern about having ulcerative colitis.
Could I just ask specifically, what would you be concerned about in terms of the ulcerative colitis and intraperitoneal therapy?
It was more that her bowel was a problem, and GI toxicity, more particularly sort of peritoneal toxicity from having an intraperitoneal catheter is a concern. A quarter of patients are going to have a significant complication. Half the patients are going to be out of complete intraperitoneal chemotherapy. And actually, in the end, the decision was partly by sort of 3-2, partly by the fact that she actually had a vaginal vault discharge and suggestion that there was going to be some leakage from that and developed a peritoneal abscess, a pelvic abscess, before ever starting chemotherapy. So the declaration of a postoperative complication actually was what really made the decision easy.
And when exactly did you see her?
We saw her 6 weeks ago.
Now, were there any clinical trial options that she'd been offered or that you thought were worth considering?
So she had reviewed the consent form for GOG 252. That's a 3-arm randomized national trial. Every arm gets bevacizumab from the second cycle of treatment and then to progression of disease. And essentially compares a modified cisplatin-based arm from GOG 172, which was Deb Armstrong's highly successful study and third randomized controlled trial that confirmed a survival advantage for intraperitoneal chemotherapy, with a carboplatin-based intraperitoneal regimen developed through phase one at the Gynecologic Oncology Group and standard intravenous paclitaxel and carboplatin.
So what specifically did you recommend to her?
So other people had actually said to her that they were concerned that the ulcerative colitis was a significant comorbidity and that that made her ineligible for that study. So we did talk about it, and she was keen to get chemotherapy off protocol as intraperitoneal treatment. And within our division, we have sort of a conflict of opinion. We have one clinician who's prepared to give carboplatin intraperitoneally based on our own phase two experience. And we have two who give it all as an outpatient. And we have five who give the GOG regimen exactly as it was given in the GOG 172 study as an inpatient.
And what did you specifically recommend to her?
So I'm in favor of the outpatient regimen. So you get paclitaxel on the first day, intraperitoneal cisplatin on the second day, and then on day 8, a week later, you come back for an intraperitoneal dose of paclitaxel.
Now, what about bevacizumab?
So what in the end she got was dose-dense paclitaxel, 80 milligrams per meter squared weekly with carboplatin AUC6 on day 1. And we actually decided against bevacizumab because of that pelvic abscess, but she was motivated to get that. It's actually hard in Massachusetts to get that outside of a clinical trial.
Interesting. And what's her current situation?
She's doing very well. She had a CA125 of 38 post-operatively, and then it's 10, I think, her most recent CA125. She's coped well with some anemia, a lower platelet count, some quite marked neutropenia down to a neutrophil count of 0.57, though we actually kept treating her. In the Japanese Gynecological Oncology Group study that compared ordinary carboplatin and paclitaxel with carboplatin and dose-dense paclitaxel, they had two dose reductions. The sort of normal neutrophil count of 1 dropping to 0.75 and then to 0.5, and likewise 100 platelets down to 75 and 50 per cubic millimeter, 1,000 cubic millimeters. So you actually can get people through treatment without many complications at really low counts with that regimen. And we've now treated quite a few people since the middle of last year and really not had many complications with dose-dense paclitaxel and carboplatin.
Any comments about intraperitoneal therapy, particularly in terms of how you do it, so to speak, or how do you and your colleagues do it, as opposed to what happens in the community? Any pearls or thoughts about that?
So the first point I'd make is that we were candid with her about the potential margin of benefit for IP therapy. So she's the sort of lady who liked numbers. So we said, you know, instead of the average patient having a recurrence at 18 months, the recurrences happened at about 2 years. And when looking at the overall survival of patients, not in terms of the percent cured, because that's always more obscure in these studies, but the actual how long people lived on average was 30% better when people got IP therapy in that third big randomized controlled trial. So it was a substantial margin of benefit. I think intraperitoneal chemotherapy really does need to be done at a center with significant patient load and level of expertise. We did a 40-patient study of just intraperitoneal carboplatin and paclitaxel, with the carboplatin given every 3 weeks and the paclitaxel given weekly, and had a really low rate of complications. But we tend to sort of get ready for a clinical trial, do due diligence in terms of training of people. And by the time a clinical trial starts, our nursing staff know that the things not to ignore on the phone. We're all aware of the sort of clinical slippery slope where people are going to be getting into problems. So quite a lot of people get low-grade peritonitis, sort of aching discomfort, some leukocytes in their abdomen, but not infection. And 2 weeks later, after not giving up treatment, quite a few of those patients will have an abscess. And about 10% of them will have occult infection. So sort of learning things is really important. So I think that IP therapy should be done in referral centers. The second thing is carboplatin is so much easier intraperitoneal than cisplatin. So the hope is that GOG-262 will show, I think a lot of people anticipate that there will be a similar survival advantage for intraperitoneal treatment, and that intraperitoneal carboplatin will be not that much different and much better tolerated.
Could you talk a little bit more about this issue of the peritonitis and abscess? What exactly is the clinical presentation, and what makes you sort of do something like hold therapy?
So my experience has been that everybody has discomfort, and it's really hard to tell whether it's sort of irritable bowel discomfort from the sigmoid. And I have some surgeons, there's a surgeon from the Beth Israel who puts in really short catheters. I've seen two patients from a fairly famous surgeon in Canada who puts in like loops of catheter, and everybody's different, but catheters hurt would be my observation. And we, for a long time, did washings, and we would find elevated leukocyte counts in washings from the peritoneum. Hard to get fluid back, but you sort of can sometimes. And that experience led into just having a really low threshold for giving antibiotics. So we give out antibiotics early in what we feel is a sort of incipient infection. A little bit like with neutropenia, our culture rate is relatively low. We'll see abscesses and they'll get drained and they'll already have started antibiotics and we won't find a bug.
Anything new in the understanding of the biology of ovarian cancer, including genomics?
There's a lot of research going on. There's going to be a big paper coming out on 400 and I think 60 patients from the Whole Genome Project, and they have serous ovarian cancer. So it's all serous, which is about 3/4 of ovarian cancer. And the three big observations are that P53 is essentially the broken thing in ovarian cancer and drives the carcinogenesis. And then secondly, that there's a massive amount of genomic instability, that it's a huge number of relatively uncommon genetic abnormalities that are characteristic of ovarian cancer, serous ovarian cancer. So things like PI3 kinase is maybe 1/4 of breast cancer patients. quarter of endometrial cancer patients, but it's 4%, I think, in that study of ovarian cancer patients. And that the third and most important thing is that DNA repair is often deregulated or abnormal in serous ovarian cancer. Now, that's exciting for PARP inhibitors, but in terms of adding to the amount of genetic instability and DNA damage is a big problem. And some of the therapeutics like Aurora kinase, which look like it might be a regulator of that, the agents against Aurora kinase have just been too toxic.
Anything in that data set that tells us more about what you were alluding to there, so-called BRCA-ness, and any markers of BRCA-ness?
Yeah, the problem at the moment is a little bit like array analysis, expression analysis from a few years ago. There was a famous meeting 3 years ago when the six groups in ovarian cancer that were looking at array analysis to try and get predictive and prognostic markers got together, and everybody had a different panel of things. The genetic analysis from the Whole Genome Project very much suggested that that was a fair reflection, that the different platforms in different labs were getting a different spectrum of a huge number of genetic abnormalities, which does suggest that we are away from a simple fingerprint that really informs either risk and therapeutic choices or may direct us to therapeutic targets like PI3 kinase in breast cancer and endometrial cancer.
What about PARP inhibitors? We saw some exciting data last year from Canada demonstrating a significant response rate in patients to olaparib with ovarian cancer without BRCA mutations.
So I think the PARP inhibitors are really exciting for two reasons. One, they offer a therapeutic option, is the anticipation for people who carry a BRCA1 or 2 mutation. There's already resistance mechanisms outlined, and our experience has been about a third of patients respond to olaparib, and that's of an average 6 months duration of benefit. The second exciting thing is that serous tumors, variably 40, 50, 60% of them, it's suggested, have BRCA-ness, that the phenotype is not necessarily genotypically BRCA mutant, but has underexpression of the BRCA protein, has epigenetic phenomena, hypomethylation, downregulation of genes, some other genes that are linked to a homologous recombination, the double-stranded DNA repair, that's the thing that's abnormal or damaged when BRCA1 or 2 mutations are present. So that BRCA-ness, I think, is potentially a really exciting option and may escalate the market for a PARP inhibitor from 5% of patients with ovarian cancer to 50% of all patients with ovarian cancer, which would be great.
As long as we're talking about new agents, what others are out there that docs in practice should know about that look encouraging that maybe are going to be available in the not too long future?
Well, I do think that the whole constellation of drugs against PI3 kinase, P10, AKT, and mTOR are very interesting, not for serous tumors, but for endometrioid ovarian cancer. So we do think that the 20% of ovarian cancer that's of this endometrioid type, that in some ways molecularly is more like endometrial cancer, and that has parallels to breast cancer, and that pathway seems to be activated in those. One of the major drivers for endometrioid tumors is this ARID1A gene that was only discovered in 2010 from David Huntsman's group. So it was a sort of sobering, humbling reminder that we are a long way from really understanding all of the pieces to the biology of these different tumors and why they differentiate differently from the same origin or a similar origin. So that class for endometrioid tumors. There's a drug, AZD6244, BRAF MET inhibitor, that really looks exciting for low-grade serous tumors. There's a lot of debate about how many of these low-grade serous tumors have BRAF as a target. When they do, it works as well as it works in melanoma. It's really quite an exciting drug. I've genotyped a lot of patients, not a lot, but maybe 20 patients, and found one patient for that. So our instance of finding BRAF mutations in low-grade patients is low. And there's an argument at the moment between MD Anderson and Johns Hopkins. And I think I sort of agree with MD Anderson that the BRAF mutations may be more common in the borderline tumors. And once tumors are invasive, they're not so commonly associated with BRAF mutations.
Just out of curiosity, did that one patient receive a BRAF inhibitor?
Yeah, she did, and she did really quite well. She was a young lady from Connecticut, and it bought her an extra year of life unequivocally. And so I think people can get really good clinical benefit. The one that we don't know about at the moment that looks promising is XL184, the vascular endothelial growth factor receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitor that's also a MEK inhibitor. And that actually looks good, really good in prostate cancer and looks good in ovarian cancer. So we are expanding the randomized discontinuation study that led to the phase 3 that's going to happen in prostate cancer. And it's already completed in prostate.
In terms of new agents, what about AMG 386, a selective angiopoietin neutralizing peptibody?
Right, it's a peptibody, which is not exactly an antibody, but very similar. And it's an anti-angiogenic. There's a phase 3 clinical trial going on. We're taking part in that, which is weekly paclitaxel with or without that agent. So it's weekly infusions of that peptibody, and 3 out of 4 weeks people get weekly paclitaxel. And it does look promising. I think it's another bevacizumab sort of thing. That seems little to differentiate it from bevacizumab.
What have you observed yourself in that trial? Or I don't know, maybe it's blinded, but in bevacizumab in general in terms of side effects and toxicity?
That study is actually yet to open at our center. It's an open study, but it's randomized, and overall survival is the endpoint. The bevacizumab side effects, I will typically tell a patient that it's fabulously well tolerated. You get headaches, nosebleeds. 10% of people get almost intolerable aches and pains in muscles and joints. But that apart from a third of people getting hypertension that needs blood pressure medications, it's a really well-tolerated treatment, unless you get a complication. And I do tell them that 3% of people get a bowel perforation that requires a colostomy, and that 1% of people gets serious bleeding, a stroke or heart attack. We've seen a couple of people with TIAs, a couple of people with reversible posterior leukoencephalopathy. We haven't really seen anybody with a proper stroke with residual deficit. And we haven't seen a single person with a myocardial infarction. So I think in non-smoking younger women, the cardiovascular profile is different and they're less at risk of those things.
I guess getting back to the AMG compound, is there any sort of reason theoretically to think it might be more or less active than, for example, bevacizumab?
I think it's to do with the degree of effect on the receptor. Imclin was very interested to bind to the receptor rather than to the ligand. And there's just not enough understood about the physiology of binding to the ligand. I think people didn't expect Genentech's strategy of binding to ligand to be as successful as it's been.
Another compound I'm curious about your take on, I think I saw your name in one of these papers, was BIBF-1120.
So there was a negative study that came out of Europe that I thought had a lot of positive things about it, but it didn't meet its primary endpoint.
How does it act?
So there's still a debate about clean, specific targeted agents against broadly acting tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So that's a relatively broadly acting tyrosine kinase inhibitor.
And what kind of toxicity and side effects are observed, TKI-like or not?
Yeah, so more towards the sorafenib spectrum. So diarrhea, plantar palmar syndrome and rashes, but same bevacizumab-like cardiovascular risks and risk of fistula and perforation.
You mentioned the option of going on the GOG study that includes bevacizumab in all three arms. Where are we right now with that strategy in actual clinical practice?
So the cytostatic agent bevacizumab it's really hard to know where it fits in the moment and the sort of right place to place it in the trajectory of the disease. So there was a lot of interest with GOG 218 meeting its primary endpoint as the first abstract in last year's ASCO meeting.
And of course, that was looking at bevacizumab and bevacizumab maintenance in patients who'd had surgery.
Right. So it's first-line therapy, unequivocally improving progression-free survival. But the margin was small, 4 months, 3.8 months. And the impact on overall survival looked negligible. And ICON 7 was a repeat of that. So the anticipation from Judah Foltman's work that bevacizumab would work best when there was microscopic disease, less than 2 millimeters in size, sort of before the angiogenic switch was flipped and blood vessels sort of drove tumor, stopping the development of blood vessels. So, you know, I treated a lot of patients in that setting, giving consolidation rather than maintenance. So I would treat them with chemo first-line therapy and then give bevacizumab as a consolidation strategy in the hope that paclitaxel, which in Murray Martin's study had shown some advantages, definitely in terms of progression-free survival, that bevacizumab would be better than paclitaxel. But that's been sort of disappointing. And actually, with the NCCN guidelines only allowing for bevacizumab being a preferred drug, something you could actually bill insurance companies for recurrent disease. We stopped using consolidation bevacizumab maybe 9 months ago, something like that.
Now, when you say consolidation, how long did you use it for?
We used it for a year and stopped.
So kind of like the maintenance part of the GOG study, I guess.
Right. But in the GOG, both 52 and 262, the treatment is to progression. I think one of that you were asking about hot things, one of the things that will be presented by Carol Agajanian at ASCO is the OCEAN study. And that doesn't yet have an overall survival endpoint that's been met, but has a substantial progression-free survival advantage for bevacizumab.
What's the design of that?
That is carboplatin and gemcitabine, same doses and schedule as the AGO gemcarbo versus carbo study. It's placebo-controlled bevacizumab every 3 weeks, and that's to progression. And the thought is that, a little bit like the colorectal study that showed that 6 months of bevacizumab's impact really peters out by 2 years and completely by 5 years and with no impact on overall survival, the thought is that you're going to have to treat people for longer. And the tension for us at the moment is more, is it better to use 6 months of bevacizumab as a therapeutic for people who have recurrent disease and ascites where it really works well, it dries up ascites really well? Is that a better use of drug than given to everybody after first-line therapy to try and improve overall survival when there's considerable doubt and no data to support doing that?
So can you talk a little bit more about the OCEAN study?
So that was patients with platinum-sensitive recurrent ovarian cancer, and they had to have measurable disease, but the primary endpoint was progression-free survival. And the FDA had a meeting with a gynecologic cancer intergroup to discuss endpoints in ovarian cancer. And Mark Brady from the GOG had presented all of the data, which very much suggested that progression-free survival advantages accurately predicted subsequent overall survival advantages in GOG phase 3 clinical trials. So it had to be really well conducted, so controlled, randomized, and blinded study, so double-blind study, so patients get salt infusion or bevacizumab. And the advantage is quite substantial. The interesting thing about the study was that the study was expanded in size and without making overall survival a primary endpoint. So overall survival is still not a primary endpoint of the study. And so at the time that the expansion happened, there was a huge amount of debate. And the hard thing ethically is denying patients benefit at progression of disease. So to ask patients to enroll, be randomized, and then agree to finish treatment and carry on with their subsequent treatment without knowing what they were on is hard. European studies, which just by virtue of the way that the system is set up, can deny people subsequent treatment, are more likely to show overall survival advantages. So I do not know the rate of crossover, but there was a substantial crossover to bevacizumab in the patients who've been on placebo in that study. And it's anticipated that's going to obscure any overall survival advantage. But the fact that the progression-free survival advantage is relatively large in that group of patients, some people are hanging their hopes on the fact that that's because the treatment was to progression, not just for a designated time after chemotherapy.
So right now in your own clinical practice outside a protocol setting, in what situations do you use bevacizumab?
So as I said, I've stopped using it as consolidation for first-line therapy. There was a vote within the NCCN ovarian committee, and the vast majority of people voted against approving bevacizumab as a maintenance or consolidation preferred drug option after first-line therapy. So I use it for people who have recurrent disease, and then I have a series of tests to reduce the risk of a gastrointestinal perforation. So people have to be eating with a good diet, without nutritional compromise. Up to third line of therapy, I think it's really safe. The ORBIT study, the one that we were involved in, where at 44 patients, there was 5 gastrointestinal perforation, the study was stopped at 11% GI perforation risk. That study, it was very much longer than 3 lines of therapy suggested, more risk of GI perforation. CT scan involvement of bowel. So I'll actually scope people. And so in the last 2 years, there's only been 2 good examples of this, but I have looked at the CT scan, thought, that looks like bowel's involved, scoped people. And on both occasions, there's been visible transmural migration of tumor. Those patients don't get bevacizumab. And then sort of more subtle things. So occasionally in the conversation with the patient, it's clear that they are very risk averse, and the thought of having a colostomy is intolerable to them. And I don't think it's wrong to say, well, that doesn't sound like it's ever going to be a good option for you, and sort of not exactly deny patients, but to agree together that bevacizumab is not a good option.
I'm kind of curious. I know you're on the NCCN ovarian committee. I'm curious whether you think they're kind of perspective, and for that matter, your perspective in terms of non-protocol therapy would be different if, let's say, the drug had minimal cost.
That's a great question. So 2 months ago in the JCO, there was a beautiful paper. So when Elizabeth Eisenhower was the commentator after 218, I think the value she put on that year of bevacizumab was $72,000. And she said it was sort of the back of an envelope calculation. There was a really formal evaluation of that in the JCO, and it was $401,000 for each progression-free year of life saved. Now, there's a quite clear analysis that suggests that politically and just personally, $50,000 to $100,000 is thought to be cost-effective for quality-adjusted lives saved, if you want. So we do actually give half-dose bevacizumab based on the ICON data, which gives half the 2.5 milligrams per kilogram per week dose as opposed to the 5. So you can halve that dose down to maybe 200,000, but with the talk that you have to treat for even longer to maybe impact survival, it's just not a cost-effective drug. So I think bevacizumab is going to be the test of cost-effectiveness, which we as a profession are dancing around as an issue at the moment.
Well, that's why I'm kind of curious, if cost was taken out, if for some reason there were minimal cost and you just were looking sort of at the clinical risk-benefit issues, do you think your view, because I'm not even sure exactly what goes into the NCCN decisions, yours and the NCCN perspective would be different?
Yeah, I would be a clinician who said cost doesn't go into the decision. The decision's a face-to-face patient-clinician discussion and decision. And the FDA approves things not on cost effectiveness, on two things. Does it impact survival? Does it improve quality of life? The Affordable Care Act doesn't have language about cost effectiveness, but everybody's anticipating that we have to address cost effectiveness. NICE in the UK, ICWIG in Germany have done that. And there was an article, the sort of clearest article about this, I think, was a JCO article recently on Provenge, this prostate cancer vaccine. You have to be like sick and almost dying to get a vaccine to buy you 4 months of extra time. That's, I forget, $30,000 a treatment or something. It's a massive amount of money. And there was no discussion of, well, can't we set a threshold? You know, the country can afford this. If you market the drug at this cost, we'll give you approval. So unfortunately, we are a free market and health is a commodity. And, you know, the Wall Street bailout is evidence that we believe in the free market still.
So how about the 62-year-old woman you just evaluated?
I saw a patient this week as a new patient who had done expectedly well after neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So she was 62 and got 3 cycles of neoadjuvant chemotherapy, very little change in her CA125.
How did she present?
She presented with distension, non-specific symptoms, and was found on examination to have a pelvic mass.
And did you see her at that point?
No, she was from Connecticut. She was operated on at Yale.
When you look back on her situation, do you think that neoadjuvant therapy was standard or an option? Shouldn't it have been done?
So at that time, Yale was actually one of the places doing this more than almost anywhere else in the country. And we have taken on more patients who get neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And we're sort of big believers. We use dose-dense treatment. And for fit people who just have really horrible disease, particularly people who would lose a lot of bowel at surgery, if you're going to have to do big bowel resections, the morbidity from big bowel resections in terms of the rest of your life having bowel compromise is hard. So with big bulky tumors, we tend to give exactly the same as the Japanese GOG, 80 milligrams per meter squared per week, paclitaxel with AUC6 carboplatin every 3 weeks. There's been some Italian studies that have divided the carboplatin dose up and given weekly. I think there's no pharmacologic merit for that. But anybody who's over 78 with significant comorbidities and just sort of poor protoplasm, you know, really sick, low albumin, low sodium, high platelet count, all of these sort of prognostic factors. And just that eyeball, you know, this person's really sick, we will give weekly carboplatin. And not infrequently, they'll get two doses of AUC2 carboplatin, paclitaxel, 60 milligrams per meter squared, and then a week off. We've had a substantial number of patients in that very poor prognostic group who you think might even not be good enough for interval size reduction later on, who've died on first-line therapy. And so really cautiously to treat people, they get really better. But like this lady, often their CA125 doesn't change that much, stays up in the hundreds. Then they get surgery, and exactly like this lady, have a dramatic fall in their CA125 with an optimal, often, like in this lady, a complete cytoreduction. Reduction. Every drop of tumour is lifted out with relatively minimally morbid surgery, you know, week in hospital, big laparotomy, but much less than they would have had at the beginning. And there was fatalities in the European study of interval cytoreduction, reduction, IGNAC-Vigot study. They really were only with the upfront therapy that people died on treatment related to surgery.
How often do you think that giving neoadjuvant therapy changes the operation, whether you can do debulking, and what's actually happening? I mean, you're not, I don't think, likely going to get a CR. Is it getting pulled back from critical structures? How does it change surgery?
So I think what we're going to need to have in the future is an array or genotyping that says your cancer is this sort of cancer, like we have in lymphoma and breast cancer with the genetic analyses. And in light of that, which we anticipate will be the best predictor prognostically of what's going to happen, tailor the treatment choices based on whether the goal is truly cure, a little bit like high-grade and low-grade lymphoma. And I think a lot of ovarian cancer is going to turn out to be like low-grade lymphoma that we never cure. And we're in a different position. It's not a small, accessible lump that you find and surgery is curative. We're debulking metastatic disease almost always in ovarian cancer. So, you know, if we had a genotype, you know, a metastasis signature like Sridhar Ramaswamy's data in lung cancer that sort of said, yeah, this is the sort of cancer that has spread and is returning, I think we would have a different strategy. And in that case, neoadjuvant chemotherapy and less morbid surgery is a really nice option. Patients really do very well with that. So this lady then finished five. So she got three cycles before surgery, five cycles of paclitaxel and carboplatin afterwards, and moves remission, and then was in remission. I think this lady was in remission for 18 months, and then her CA125 went up 100, 200, and she had just ascites on her CT scan. So not eligible for any of the clinical trials because she didn't have measurable disease, and we had a discussion about treatment. And for people with platinum-sensitive recurrent disease, there's three options: paclitaxel and carboplatin based on ICON-4, gemcitabine and carboplatin based on the AGO study, and the Calypso study, which showed that pegylated liposomal doxorubicin with carboplatin was superior in terms of progression-free survival when compared with paclitaxel and carboplatin. So that combination, based on the Calypso study, is a real favorite. We've sort of gone over to using PLD and carboplatin.
And again, what about bevacizumab?
So there's only a limited number of patients. There's one abstract at ASCO of PLD with bevacizumab from the New York group, Franco Muggia's group. So there's not much experience of that. I've said to a few patients, and I really wrestle with this, and I tend to actually limit the bevacizumab to the patients who do poorly. They don't finish second-line therapy with a complete response. I tend to then give Cytoxan and bevacizumab as sort of consolidation to try and buy them the most time. There's definitely patients that don't get into a second remission who sort of then are like platinum-resistant patients and have tough disease and constantly on treatment. And bevacizumab and low-dose metronomic oral cytoxans are a really nice option for them.
And what happened with this lady?
So she's thinking about a clinical trial. One of the things that we're doing is in people who are relatively well, so she has ascites on a scan, she actually has a palpable axillary lymph node that we quite commonly see as FNA positive. And we are actually talking with her about waiting till she has symptomatic progression of disease, at which time she will be eligible for a clinical trial. And so we're treading water with two things. One, the data from Gordon Rustin's study that starting treatment too early compromises quality of life without impacting survival. And the second, we are now routinely genotyping people. So for 3.5 weeks, a little bit of archival tumor in the lab, $3,500 insurance company cost, we can do a thing called Snapshot that checks 10,000 bits of the 3 billion pieces of code in our DNA, and 5-10% of the time we find a useful target, PI3 kinase mutation or AKT or something. Some of them not so useful, P53, KRAS, you know, it's a mutation but not of any therapeutic benefit in terms of identifying a target.
What about BRCA testing in a woman this age? You know, you hear people talking about that in breast cancer, you know, in triple negative disease, maybe they'd be more likely to use platinums or whatever. Any point in doing BRCA testing from the point of view of the patient herself at this age without a family history?
Right. I've now started to BRCA gene test everybody who has a more than 2-year recurrence-free interval. And that does sort of select for a group of patients who we find inherited predisposition mutations. And like we discussed earlier on, what we really want is a better test that really evaluates the functional BRCA gene expression in protein or some epigenetic assay. Because the thought is that a lot of these people do have the BRCAness phenotype.
And you mentioned her axillary node. Any comments in general about extra-abdominal metastases in ovarian cancer in terms of where it's seen and maybe areas that people ought to be more aware of?
Yeah, so the two things that I really sort of believe is that there's a nice paper in Gynonc maybe 2 years ago or something that evaluated classic symptoms that would suggest somebody had a brain metastasis, and only 1 in 5 women with classically sinister symptoms actually had brain metastasis. So brain metastases are really rare. It's much more likely people have nausea from intra-abdominal disease and just don't feel good and have a headache from being on therapy or something. The reverse sort of thing is true of people that you worry might have a second malignancy, a new breast cancer. I would say most axillary nodes in people with advanced ovarian cancer is metastasis to nodes outside the abdomen. So very common to find a Virchow node or axillary nodes in patients with advanced ovarian cancer that's just metastasis from the ovarian cancer.
Interesting. What about inguinal or femoral nodes?
Those are really sort of slightly more rare than axillary nodes. Well, maybe not. Maybe similarly not common. And they're almost always from ovarian cancer.